with Daniel Pinchback. He's a radical futurist or philosopher and the author of How Soon Is Now. And Daniel, I know that you feel it's important for us to, and you just had a great riff on imagining a future, a new future, which is, I think, key, like to start to develop a better party, as they say. And in that way that you have pointed out, let's say, how we need to have this plan imagined, or some plans imagined, at least some multiple plans imagined in place to fill a void that will be extant when things start to shift in a big way, especially climate change. So let's say you use the example of the fall of the Berlin Wall, mm-hmm. which I thought was significant. We're all so happy. Oh, the wall fell. Nobody saw it. Well, some people saw it, but it fell. But what was the aftermath of that? What happened in the aftermath?
Yeah, so like one of the things I look at in the book is you know, we don't know what's going to happen. Like, there could be unanticipated massive changes, like the Berlin Wall falling. As far as I know, nobody predicted that, you know, people were going to rise up and peacefully take the wall down and they wouldn't be shot at by police, or, you know, there wouldn't be, you know, wars or whatever around it. So it just happened. People were done with it, you know. So that could happen. Something like that could happen again, even in the West, you know, in a way with Trump. Many people must be having a subliminal realization that this is, like, not tolerable in a way. But the problem is that there needs to be good ideas in place if a crisis happens and change is going to come. So, for instance, like starting in the 60s, there were a bunch of right-wing economists, the neoliberal kind of Chicago school, like Milton Friedman, and they didn't like the Great Society. They didn't like the fact there was like better education for more people, and the middle class was growing, and there was more dissent and so on. So they saw that they couldn't really advance their ideas at that point. So they created academic departments and think tanks and magazines and a whole network of institutions. And then they were ready, like for Reagan, and then for the fall of the wall. And then they moved in, you know, they were like, okay, well, what you do is you privatize all the state-owned resources, you sell them to the highest bidder, you know, you create oligarchies, and that's going to be the way forward. You know, so they had a big influence on what happened to those countries after the Soviet Union split apart, negative influence.
The important thing there was that they sold off, let's say, the commons, which was owned commonly by everyone. Suddenly they got sold off to private individuals, the highest bidder.
Exactly. But also the other point that I was really making was that Milton Friedman said that when a crisis comes, the ideas that get applied are the ones that are lying around. So their job was to have their ideas ready to be implemented. So that's one reason why I felt it was really important to get this book out, because I felt like, you know, there's going to be more crises. We need, you know, different ideas about what changes could happen, you know.
Well, that's when things are going well, it's hard to change the system. But when things are breaking down, that's a very, very creative moment, is what you're talking about. And so what you are talking about is to apply our best imagination, our best intelligence toward what really serves us deeply, not just superficially.
Yeah, well, and then the other problem is that if we don't, you know, like it doesn't look like, you know, the ecological crisis is such a serious thing that unless we really do change direction soon, you know, it's going to hit us like a brick wall, you know.
I remember David Suzuki talking about the ecological crisis. He's a biologist in Vancouver, Canada, and he was talking about how we're headed towards that brick wall in a car, but we're in the trunk and not really in the driver's seat. So he was really warning us years and years ago to really take a look at it and to do what we can now, because this is the time to really make a difference. So I'd like to also say that you talk about it's not so much a revolution as it is a metamorphosis. Can you say something about that?
in my efforts to kind of envision how this could happen. I mean, I'm very interested in like the evolution of social technologies and the internet. You know, there's like a connection historically between the type of social organization and the type of media that we have. So we could never have had like empires like Rome until we had, unless we had a written code of laws. We could never have had nation states, you know, like the European ones and US and all around the world that we have now, without the printing press that people could vote and share certain knowledge. And now we have the internet, which is an interactive communications network, kind of like a global nervous system. And it points towards, you know, other potentials and how we can organize ourselves, how we can make decisions together, how we can exchange value. It could be much more like a participatory direct democracy that scales from local to bioregional to, you know, planetary. And it could be that, you know, the kind of solutions that we're gonna come across are not going to be like a revolution and you know, battles and then breakdowns. It might happen like that, but it may be more that we develop new tools that make people's lives better and propagate really, really quickly. And also, you know, different ways of approaching the crises that we're facing. But, you know, they would ultimately, I think, take us away from this current economic system. As an example, like I talk in the book about regen villages. The Stanford University professor has created these kind of like modular, mass producible housing units that have like composting, you know, aquaponics, renewable energy all built into them. So they're like, you know, totally like resilient and self-sufficient little units. And, you know, so you have all these refugees who are settled in these refugee camps where they can't do anything. You know, what if you could just create these compounds out of these regen villages so people could take care of their own basic needs and sort of resettle, you know, rather than being in limbo.
I encourage people to look that up on the internet, and you can see pictures of it. It's region, R-E-G-E-N .org, I think, or com. And you can look it up, Google it, and it's wonderful to kind of look at it. And I believe that really goes back to all the ideas that Bucky Fuller was talking about, you know, 40, 50 years ago, that he envisioned something like that.
Yeah, Buckminster Fuller is one of the big inspirations for this book, for sure.
You also mentioned briefly something about participatory democracy. Uh-huh. So how would that look different than what we have right now, capitalist democracy?
Yeah, well, I mean, some tech companies have been building kind of infrastructure to test out those ideas. There's one for local communities. It's called Lumio, Lomio.org, two O's. And it's actually based on Occupy principles. So in Occupy, they developed this, you know, decision-making structure where people would, you know, vote yes, no, abstain, or block. And if you block, it means that you really hate the measure. And if it goes through, then you're going to leave the group, you know. So they basically created a little platform where you could take anybody. Like you could take all your friends and put them on a Lumio group. And they could start making decisions together. Like, do we all want to wear red socks Tuesday, or do we want to go to this, you know, protest or whatever? So Lumio is interesting. It's actually being used by a movement in Spain called Podemos, which is a grassroots sort of leftist movement. Podemos means we can. So it's being used as their organizing tool for local communities. And another one is called, from Argentina, it's called Democracy OS. And that's for larger, it could be for municipalities. And there the idea is like, you know, we have to think about our governments and our voting system. It's very antiquated technology. I mean, the governments were formed in the 18th century when things moved at like horse and buggy speed. And, you know, and there's no reason now that we should only be able to vote on one of every two corrupt choices every 4 years. You know, we should be able to be ongoingly participatory in our decisions that affect us. So the Democracy OS platform allows for that. It would be like, okay, like maybe I know that I'm not an expert on water, But I know that my friend Fred, you know, has really studied it. So I proxy my vote in that area to him. But then later on, if I learn that Fred is taking a kickback from Pepsi, I don't have to wait like 4 years to vote Fred out of office. I just immediately take my vote away and give it to somebody else. Right. So it'd be more like an instantaneous infrastructure for decision making.
So with that, there are two things that occur to me. It needs an informed citizenry. So we need to really commit ourselves to being informed, not maybe on everything, but to rely on respected friends and coworkers and colleagues.
We either have to get stupider or we have to get smarter. I mean, we're getting stupider. So are we stupid enough to, like, you know, become slaves to a kind of technocratic, authoritarian, fascist regime? That's kind of the way it's going, and maybe that's the way it's going to go. But my book is positing an alternative, which is harder and requires us to, you know, embrace our responsibility for understanding what's happening, for caring for the world, you know, for, you know, looking after our own communities, for knowing things and so on. And, you know, that's like Buckminster Fuller also really said that, like, you know, humans are meant to be generalists. Like, we have the capacity to learn and understand everything. And we have a society that's turned everybody into kind of specialists. So they only think that they're supposed to know about one little arena. And, you know, that's one reason why I really did this book, because I didn't know anything about political theory or agriculture or energy or the ecological crisis. I was just like, look, like, you know, how do I learn about this stuff? How do I put it together? If I can understand it, then maybe I can help other people also understand it.
That's great. That's great. Let's just talk about energy. If we had renewable energy right now, if we just suddenly no more oil and energy was free all over the planet, would we be able to cope with that psychologically or with our present consciousness?
If we had windmills and solar, we'd be great. I mean, in the book, I look at this, you know, some people talk about, like, Nassim Harabin is somebody who's talked a lot about it, although he hasn't really been able to, you know, the proof is in the pudding. He hasn't been able to show us a device. But this idea that maybe we're ultimately going to be able to, you know, create an unlimited energy based on, like, quantum fluctuations in the vacuum or something. You know, if we had unlimited energy right now, like if we had a free energy device, I think we wouldn't be in trouble at this level of consciousness, because that would just let us to, you know, mine the last crystals and get the last fish and so on. So, you know, it may be, that's why I look at this whole process as maybe it's like, you know, maybe there's a wisdom in nature that actually isn't, you know, just in natural systems that, you know, but maybe we're extension of a natural system, and there's a wisdom in the process that we have to go through this kind of initiation or you know, turmoil or you know, a certain level of sacrifice and suffering, so that we are prepared and primed for you know, a greater capacity later.
So I think that that's a really important point, and it gets to the whole idea of rite of passage, initiation. And I'd like to have you talk a little bit about your view and your experience of initiation. I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Daniel Pinchback. He's the author of How Soon Is Now? From Personal Initiation to Global Transformation. And if you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website, howsoonisnow.info. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. here with Daniel Pinchback. He's the author of How Soon Is Now? Daniel, we're talking about initiation and being a collective consciousness ready for this change. And let's go back to initiation. What, in indigenous culture, what did initiations serve, these rites of passage? How did they serve?
Yeah, I mean, you find like initiations like in cultures all around the world, particularly for men, although for, you know, women also. And the idea was that to, you know, make the boundary between like adolescence and adulthood, people needed to go through a kind of culturally created ordeal that often involved or generally involved, you know, reaching altered states of consciousness, visionary states. So it could be with psychedelic plants like ayahuasca or peyote or mushrooms. Could be through like fasting and walkabouts or sun dances where you're actually like, you know, your pectoral muscles are skewered and you're on a tree for days. And, you know, I guess we tend to think that it's just a cultural process, but actually it might almost have like a neurophysiological basis where like the part of our brain that makes us most distinctly human, which is like the prefrontal cortex, allows us to use language and plan for the long term, but also gives us a very kind of, you know, strong sense of our ego identity, of a separate identity, almost so strong that, you know, we feel alienated or detached in a way from others. You know, but when you have an experience of cosmic consciousness or whatever, or transpersonal consciousness or connection to nature through something like psychedelics, you break through that ego structure. And therefore, you recognize that it's not just about you. You know, you're actually just, you know, a spirit that's connected to the evolution of these other spirits in your tribe and in the larger community of life. And then you can make decisions that are more responsible for the whole.
So
in a way, if we look at Trump, for instance, as like the apotheosis of the, you know, somebody who's trapped in their ego, who's like a kid alt, who's totally sees the world through self-interest, who really, you know, doesn't really have that idea of like, you know, what's my role in the community of life, you know?
So I think of the concept of empathy, that somehow this creates in some way more empathy. As you say, if the egoic structure starts to break down, one would see the world differently.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, yeah. And I'm thinking also, you mentioned that mostly these initiations are done with men. And I think about women. Women have these initiations, first of all, every month,
yeah,
once they come into,
yeah,
their menses. And if those women who have actually given birth, that certainly is a rite of passage, yeah, in the same way. And I'm also thinking about the idea of if we are going towards a very new collective cultural society, it's like we are in a birth, collectively, a birth tunnel right now. And in that birthing, there ain't no going back. I mean, we're right in the middle of it and it's painful. There is pressures. But there's no way in that, like in actual physical birth, that a baby goes back up into the womb.
Right.
So do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, we're in a kind of, we have to go through this process and, you know, it's like, we're not going to go back to being tribal people, you know, we're, you know, unless there's like a massive, you know, breakdown of our support systems or whatever. I mean, you know, hopefully there's a, as I said, like an evolutionary process that's happening. And, you know, we can look at the last couple of centuries and we can see this tremendous momentum, you know, the discovery, you know, even though the, you know, as I write about in other books, the discovery of psychedelics in the modern world and how those have impacted our consciousness and the development of the internet and how we now, you know, as we're entering this period of crisis, we have this collective nervous system where we can share ideas and tools instantly and so on. So, yeah, so hopefully there's a teleology in a way to it, like a purpose to it, which is to, I hope, bring us to being kind of like a truly planetary civilization where, you know, we care for each other collectively.
I know that you've used the analogy of the different institutions that can be used in some ways. I mean, they are set up. They can be retooled, let's say. So if you take the nervous system of the body that's like the internet. Yeah. And then you take the sanitation, all the sanitation industry that's like, you get the analogy I'm going for. Can you describe that more fully for us?
Sure. Yeah. Well, in the book I look at, if we think about humanity as a giant organism, then what are the sort of the primitive versions of organs in that organism? And in a way, there are a lot of them are multinational corporations. It's like energy companies are kind of like the circulation system with the blood and so on. And media companies are kind of like our perceptual mechanisms, the eyes and the ears of the body, which take in like raw sense data, then they convert it into kind of directives that the whole thing follows. But at the moment, it's all perverse because it's all based on financial capital, profit, control, you know. So we're not getting the messages are deformed or you know, corrupted, you know. But if you look at the history of evolution, it turns out now, like, you know, biologists talk about that cooperation is more the nature of successful evolution rather than competition. Like, you know, cooperation ultimately outcompetes competition. And as I talk about in the book, like, we have so much cooperation going on that we don't even think about. Like, you know, for me to drink this coffee cup, you know, the coffee came from Italy, you know, or Africa, you know, the cup came from China, you know, the oil that makes it comes from Russia, you know, the water is local, you know, so like a whole world of cooperation is involved even in the simple act of like having a cup of coffee. So that's pretty extraordinary. And it's very much like, you know, how things work in our bodies that are invisible to us. You know, our bodies are organizing all these things all the time. But yeah, but in terms of our global paradigm on a civilizational level, it's still based on domination, exploitation, and control. And we also really have to realize that we in the developed world of the West have been the beneficiaries to a great extent of a system of domination and exploitation and of the waste of CO2. And we have a lot of responsibility for this situation. That's where like I get frustrated, for instance, with the Northwest culture of like hippies and the kind of luxury hippiedom and so on. I feel that in a way I was happy when Harbin, it's terrible to say, but I was almost happy when Harbin Hot Springs burned down. I mean, not that I loved Harbin, but I feel that energy that's been held here gets a little bit insular. And we need people who've gotten the message now to go out to the red states or, you know, the Middle East or wherever and bring the seeds of change and healing and transformation to these other cultures. Because that's, you know, I feel that what happened with the election, there's a tremendous frustration on the part of the middle of the country. They're aware that this progress has been happening on the, you know, the West Coast, the East Coast. You know, money has flooded here, you know, developments, yoga, and, you know, culturally, spiritually, and financially. And they've just been left out. And they're given two crappy choices between, like, you know, a horrible Trump or horrible Hillary. And they're like, we'll just take the, why should we settle for the lesser evil? We'll just say, you know, screw it to the whole system, you know. And so I think that it's the cultural elites who've, you know, supposed to be the more conscious elements who really haven't really been showing up and doing what needs to be done to, like, heal all these divides in the world.
What about the letter that Zuckerberg wrote, who's the creator of the of Facebook? What did you think of that letter?
I was not very impressed by that letter. I didn't think it meant very much. I mean, he talked about communities, but he's, you know, like, for instance, these guys never talk about wealth inequality. I mean, you know, Zuckerberg's, Facebook depended on the public infrastructure of the internet. I mean, the guy who invented the internet, Timothy Berners-Lee, you know, didn't try to privatize or patent the internet. He was like, this is a resource for humanity. And so now these guys have made huge fortunes by privatizing the commons, essentially, and closing the commons. And I don't think it's right, really. I think that, you know, what Facebook is, but I reward their, you know, intelligence, their acumen, and so on. But I think now they have to go through a shift in consciousness and realize that, like, you know, what Facebook is essentially a public infrastructure in private hands that is being, you know, used to support this capitalist system, which is destructive of the planet, you know, and we need public infrastructure that is going to really, you know, allow for these other emergences of, you know, for instance, imagine if Facebook could be used as a tool to deal with the ecological crisis. Like, you know, every time the 1.5 billion people a day who use Facebook opened up the tool, it could say, hey guys, guess what? We've overshot the limits of the planet. We are now in a serious problem. We can change it, but it's going to take concerted effort. This is what you need to know about what's happening globally. This is what you need to know about what's happening locally. Here's a way you can do, forget about using your own car all the time. You can do ride shares. We can, everybody's connected now. Here's the ride shares. You can share your tools. Why buy a new drill or a new washing machine? Use your neighbors, connect, you know, like, et cetera, et cetera. Like, it could, you know, the internet could be used as the infrastructure for people to create cooperative and participatory decision-making structures, share resources efficiently, identify the types of things that need to be done ecologically, whether it's bioremediation or permaculture or urban farming or whatever, and then make those the priorities.
Oh, great. So that's, we just have, you know, just a few seconds left. Is there any one piece of advice you would give to an individual of what an individual could do to support this?
I mean, they first need to have a comprehensive understanding of the whole design. And I feel my book is helpful for that. But then there's also other books like, you know, Buckminster Fuller's work, Operation Spaceship Earth, Utopia or Oblivion are still very relevant. You know, Post-Capitalism by Paul Rifkin, by Paul Mason. I think it's called The Fourth Industrial Revolution by Jeremy Rifkin. You know, McDonough's book, Cradle to Cradle. I think that there's a certain level of education that people need to do. And then they need to integrate that and then think about their talents and skills and capacities and how they want to apply them.
Apply them. Yeah. Thank you so much, Daniel, for being with us today. I've been with Daniel Pinchbeck, and he is the author of How Soon Is Now. If you'd like to know more about his work, you can go to his website, howsoonisnow.info. By the way, he spells his last name Pinchbeck, P-I-N-C-H-B-E-C-K. You can also go to the New Dimensions website to plug into his website. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3604.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org, or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support, and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Mark Nepo, author of Falling Down and Getting Up, and next time on New Dimensions, I'll be exploring the dance and rhythm of transformation as it moves through our lives.
For the past two decades, CJSF 90.1 FM has been the game-changing radio station people have tuned in to listen, share, discuss, and celebrate. From authors, actors, and entertainers to journalists, business leaders, and sports figures, CJSF has welcomed esteemed guests giving you the best in music, news, and spoken word, undoubtedly changing the sound of community radio since 2003. CJSF, diverse, independent, yours.
You're listening